So do you remember on the first day I wanted to, I said that the main goal was to think of gravity as part of our core theory. And we've gotten partway there by showing how the construction of gravity is fits in with the construction of the other fundamental interactions. The thing we haven't done, we have work to do today, is to show how the theory makes sense as a quantum theory and how you can make predictions in it. And we had this quote from Feynman. I hope I'm on among equally irrational men. I hope I won't be criticized so that there's no practical reason for making these calculations. And for a while, I thought I knew how to do this, I held off myself. But in a way, I think the practical reason is to change the view of the issue of gravity and quantum mechanics. These are all quotes from famous people. They're outdated in present view, and we need to know why they're outdated. We in fact can make good quantum calculations in such a theory. The key to this is this effective field theory that we discussed in detail the first day.
Are you going to name those people?
I know I won't name the people. I'll name them at the end. There's a person who I give a positive quote. I'll name them. I first pulled this out at a conference where several of these were sitting in the audience, and I have no idea if they recognize their own words, but. Anyhow, so the rules of the effective field theories that we, as we developed, is they're not at all strange. We identify what the low energy particles are and what their symmetries are. We write out a general Lagrangian involving those fields and only those fields. We order it in the energy expansion. We'll then take the one that's active at the lowest energies and quantize it. We renormalize, match or measure the parameters, and then get predictions from the residual effects from low energy propagation. And we've gotten partway there. Here's our effective Lagrangian that's invariant on the symmetries. It contains only gravitons. And then we can, of course, add S matter that also contains matter fields and gravitons. And we measured this to be small on normal scales. We measured that to be Newton's constant. Kappa squared is 32 pi g Newton. And these guys, we didn't talk too much about. We're very insensitive to them. If they were enormously large, we could be sensitive to them. And so I actually have left it as an exercise for you guys in the exercises thing. But basically what happens, if these things are excessively large, then you have two derivatives and four derivatives. You can write that as a Newtonian potential that has a Yukawa piece. And then these get bounded by, they're less than 10 to the plus 65. Okay. Now the dimensionless numbers in other theories, you'd expect them to be order unity, but they, you know, in principle, we expect lambda to be bigger too. So who knows what to expect. But anyhow, they're bounded experimentally to be less than 10 to the plus 65. And so this is, of course, after they've been renormalized, but let's just deal with that part right now. So now, before I go on to the gravity part, let's first do the scalar.
Can I just ask
a sure.
question? So you haven't mentioned anomalies yet.
Yeah.
Don't they somewhat undermine the whole program?
You don't think so.
Your assumption is the action can be expressed as a local, in terms of local operators.
Right. The anomalies, though, they're calculable anomalies, and you will, in fact, see them later on appear when I do R log box R. I'm going to, at some stage, do them. Those are
that's
the
not local
Those are not local. But they're calculable.
Right, but you...
So this is the most general local Lagrangian.
Right, so is that a rule that I can always express what happens at high energy with a local Lagrangian?
Well, you can always come up with really crazy schemes that where it doesn't. Let's imagine that there's a breakdown of space-time and at very high energies. If I go in here, I come out 10 light years away, okay? Then at very high energies, what happens here and what happens there are correlated, okay? But if you're just, if you're just doing fields on normal space-time, and then it's the uncertainty principle that says that high energy effects are local at low energies.
Sure, but there are counterexamples.
Yeah, I have this. Another counterexample is if the world is a big brain, it goes out, it comes around, it comes back. They're very close together here, and your influence here is there. But
this question matters if we're interested in finding the final theory.
Yes, I know.
This philosophy basically says that's hopeless.
This philosophy says that I'm gonna deal with the effects. I am making an assumption about what space-time looks like, that it's four-dimensional, that points here are not connected to distant points. There are some assumptions there, but they're the assumptions that we make in all our field theories. They're not anything new.
Some theories are complete.
Yes, and this is not a complete theory, yes. And so...
So those are very nice theories, but there's no kind of hint of that.
Well, who knows if the standard model is complete, right? QCD is a nice theory, but who knows if it's complete? It devolves into some, strings at some high energies, it's a renormalizable theory, but renormalizable theories may not be the end. You may want to have finite theories.
Yeah.
But isn't it true that at some level, at a fractal level, cluster decomposition is what you're building in with locality? And then there's an observational question as to if you want to have spontaneous symmetry breaking, that's also coming from cluster decomposition. So there must be some sort of a bound at some level that the fact we see symmetry breaking happen tells us that cluster decomposition works, and it must be possible that if I give you a non-local theory, is there a constraint I can put on it from cluster decomposition? This may be taking you into the direction you want to go.
Yeah, this is the direction I don't want to go. Ow! All right. I think we should be prepared to that all of the fundamental ingredients of our theories could break down. And we're taking the fundamental theories to be the fundamental aspects of it to be there is a locality, causality, cluster decomposition, set of arguments that we build into all our theories, and I'm doing it here too. If those ingredients disappear, I will have to rethink all my other theories also. For example, in this example where we have links between here and there because of space-time is connected in some ways, that would be true in QCD too. If you do QCD, you're going to have your jets come out there. So I'd have to rethink all my theories. So I'm doing the conservative approach. I'm taking the same assumptions that I do for my other theories and applying it here. Okay. So in the case of the scalar, so we have the scalar that has the action. Mu phi, and let's forget about masses. Let's just do that. Masses don't change the underlying structure. At this stage, we can take the G mu nu to be background fields, and and integrate out the scalar fields, and then look at what the residual interaction is. The technique goes through these heat kernel coefficients, the renormalization. These have all been worked out by mathematicians in advance, so I don't really have to do much. I just have to look it up. The answer is that the divergent part of this is 1 over 16 pi squared, 1 over 180. One over epsilon plus dot dot dot, the usual stuff there. And then I get 3 r mu nu minus r squared. If you didn't want to trust those mathematicians, so it comes out as a local term in the Lagrangian as advertised. It will go into the renormalization of those coefficients C1 and C2. It's a piece of that. Interesting thing here is that it's order derivative to the fourth. So you get that automatically with these fields. You can, in fact, do this if you want the old-fashioned way. If I were trying to just figure out how you do it, I would do something that let's look at two gravitons coupled up to the scalar going through the loop. And I know from the Feynman rule that this vertex is of order e squared, that vertex is of order e squared. When I do dimensional regularization, there's no other parameters that come in. And so I would get that to be of order e to the fourth, which is then an effect of Lagrangian of order derivative to the fourth. And in fact, you can do it this way. If you do that, you can just look at the terms, and the tensor structure tells you that there's the 3 there and 3 over 180 and 1 over 180. You can pull it out that way. Okay. This also tells you something else. It also tells you that if I added renormalizable interactions like lambda phi to the fourth. Let's add lambda phi to the fourth. Well, I wouldn't want to do this calculation, but here's a diagram with lambda phi to the fourth interactions. It's a tree loop diagram. The power counting is exactly the same. This is lambda up here. This is lambda down there. They're dimensionless parameters. By dimensional analysis, this is also the order derivative to the fourth. So in fact, the pattern that you see there is true of all renormalizable field theories, to all orders in their loops. Not talking about gravitational loops. But if I do QCD loops at one loop, you get order derivatives to the fourth. And I do QCD corrections to that, I get still order derivative to the fourth. So the renormalizable field theories all end up with divergences at that order. Okay. We're interested in doing the same thing then for gravity. And this was done by Tuft and Veltman. It's conceptually simple. So I'll write simple in quotes. It's a real bear. It's a heroic calculation to actually do for the first time. But conceptually, it's quite simple. And basically, here you're going to use the background field method. You're going to say g mu nu is some background gravitational field, g bar mu nu, plus a quantum fluctuation. Here I'm putting this kappa in front of the h mu nu just to make the kinetic energy pieces come out looking nice. And then you do an expansion in this background field. expansion in the quantum field, I'm sorry. So for example, if you have a connection We write that as the connection of the background field plus, here's notation lambda mu nu. I'll put one bar under it, means the first order in H. And then you need second order in H, et cetera. So you expand in this way. And I just want to, I'll show you just one. I'll show you this one. Because I want to make a point associated with it. And we won't show you all the details. So gamma lambda mu nu at first order in H has the following form. It sort of looks like a connection. It's 1/2. There's a G bar up here, a lambda sigma, and then it's covariant derivative mu H nu sigma. It's covariant derivative nu H mu sigma minus covariant derivative sigma H mu nu. Reason for showing this is that it organizes itself. This is covariant derivative with respect to the background field. Okay? That's why the bar is over that. Was that your question?
Yes.
Okay. And the expansion that comes out is covariant with respect to G bar. With the background field. And that's important. So each step of the way, you're preserving the background field gauge invariance. Okay. The end result is I'm not going to show you the whole thing. I'll give you a term or two. So the Lagrangian that you get out it's the expansion of 2 over kappa squared r. It's 2 over kappa squared, sorry.
Are you also including the root g in what you were going to write there?
Yeah, I should include the root g, thank you. It's fine as a d bar. I'm sure you can see the bar over that g. Anyhow, that's the leading piece. Actually, let's stick that square root of G bar outside of everything since I don't want to write it in front of everything. Let's do that. And then the first order pieces will vanish by the equations of motion. And at second order, I get terms that look pretty standard. I get the first term is 1/2 D. D alpha, that's an alpha, let's make it an alpha, bar H mu nu, D bar alpha H mu nu. Okay, everything here is raised and lowered with the background metric. Then there's a bunch of other terms like this that come in. And then there are some terms that explicitly have the curvature. Let's write one out. Yeah. So here's one that's H lambda lambda R mu nu H mu nu. So there's a bunch of terms like this. There's no point in seeing them all. It's not that interesting. But there is also a point is that one can see that there is a gauge invariance, not only with respect to the background field, which we talked about, but there's also a gauge invariance H mu nu. So if you make a small coordinate transformation, so X mu goes to X prime mu equals X mu plus C mu of X, where this is small. There's a background invariance of H, which is just the residual one from the usual piece. H goes to H prime mu nu, which is H mu nu plus D mu C nu D bar mu plus D bar nu D mu. And so there's a gauge invariant of the fluctuation.
In the first line, the R mu nu should have a bar in it.
And that should have a bar. Okay. But already we have an important result. So I will do gauge fixing, but I'll do it in a way that's covariant with respect to the background field. So we'll still, the end product is going to still end up being covariant for the background field. So when we do divergences, they will come out to be invariant. Okay. Because of this gauge invariance here, we'd need to do gauge fixing. And the extension of what we did before, we did a harmonic gauge. Here we take a constraint C nu, which is D bar mu. Let's see, I want that to be upper. Might as well get it right. H mu nu minus 1/2 D bar nu H lambda lambda. That's going to be our gauge constraint in the way that previously we had used a similar constraint for harmonic gauge where the derivatives were just ordinary derivatives. Okay.
Are you going to flat impose that, or are you going to put a gauge fixing term in the action?
Okay, I'm going to continue to do this, but I'll do Fedeya Popov Ghost now. Okay. So last time what we did is we just set it, we imposed it on the equations of motion, we inverted, and we sort of did it the old-fashioned way. So here I will take a few minutes to remind you of how we do gauge fixing in gauge theories, and then do this here and pull out the Fedeya Popov ghosts for you. Okay, because it's not something you find everywhere in the literature, so let's just do it. So recall gauge theories. This may not be the easiest to recall, it's the thing you tend to forget first. But what you do when you're doing gauge fixing in usual gauge theories is you add the unit operator, unity in a funny way. If your gauge parameter is theta, you write a term that involves a constraint. So let's have delta of some gauge constraint. There's my gauge field. The gauge transformation is theta minus something. I'll just call it f of x. I do it right. This is a path integral, but then the path integral has a Jacobian, which is the determinant df theta. Okay. So that's an identity. We insert that into the path integral. I won't do this in full detail, but just to remind you where things come with. We then exponentiate. I can write this. This is integral df e to the I. Let's see what. Let me get my exact numbers here. Minus I over 2c integral for x of f squared times this delta function, delta F of A minus F of X. And that exponentiates the gauge constraint. So e to the minus I integral d4x c over 2 f of a squared. So this, I need a parenthesis there. Okay, so this is how you add the gauge constraint to the action by this part of the trick. The residual piece is this Fedea-Popov determinant, and you evaluate the determinant with these ghost fields. Okay, so the determinant of df theta is written then as the integral over the path integral over fermionic ghost fields e to the I integral d4x c bar df theta c. Okay. So this, you're instructed then to find the variation of the gauge constraint with the gauge parameter. Yes?
If you just go up there.
Yeah.
What is theta a function of in the top integral?
Theta is your gauge parameter. So I'm going to look at how the gauge constraint varies with theta in the determinant. And so this is a gauge parameter. So this is, if this was QCD, I mean QED, it'd be A mu goes to A mu plus D mu theta in QED.
We wrote there as theta of X, right?
It's theta of X. It's, and this is path integral. Okay, does that clarify what it is? Yes.
So when you do gauge fixing for non-abelian gauge theories, you find that the ghosts, they help to cancel non-physical modes.
Yes.
Is it the same for gravity?
Yes. Yes. So, if you remember the story, that's exactly how it was found. So Feynman had this tree theorem where he felt he could reconstruct loops from only using on-shell physical degrees of freedom, and he found that when he did the calculation, he didn't get the same answer in gravity and Yang-Mills. And so he put these little dopey particles in and put them in with a minus sign to subtract them out, okay? And this is the formalism that does that. The fermionic nature gives you the minus sign, this is exactly what it does. It subtracts out the unphysical degrees of freedom that are present in this gauge. They're not present in all gauges, but this gauge they are. Okay, so let's do this now for gravity. Yeah.
They're present in gauges which are not completely gauge fixed.
Well, but there are also axial gauges where you don't need ghosts.
Yes, so those are completely gauge fixed.
That's okay. Yes. Yes.
Or residual gauge transformations, which leave you still satisfying the gauge condition. For example, the Lorentz gauge. So
yes.
That's why you need the ghosts to get rid of those.
Yes. Okay, so here our constraint was C nu is D mu H mu nu minus, did I have a half up there? Let me go back and see. D nu H lambda lambda. Did I write that down correctly before? Let's just go back up and see. Yes, I did. Good. So when I do the exponentiation, I'm basically adding the gauge fixing term, L gauge fixing, which is Well, I choose the parameter C to be 1, so it's 1 half C nu. I add that to the Lagrangian, and it's, you know, just looks just like a typical piece here. That's, it's hard to differentiate that from the other pieces. It actually simplifies the structure. Okay, but now we're instructed to, for the determinant, to look at how the gauge constraint changes with the gauge transmission. Yes.
And those are D bars.
These are D bars. Yes. Thank you.
Perhaps you go put gauge parameters in. Are you going to do that? Or are you going to have a?
I didn't. I am not going to do that. It would be. The harmonic gauge is nice because it's as simple a propagator as you can do, and you've got enough tensor indices already. I've not had the nerve to venture beyond that. But we know it's gauge invariance in a way, because we also, as I'll tell you later, we also have done calculations using unitarity techniques and get the same answer. So there's no gauge in fixing involved there. Okay, so unfortunately in my notes here I changed mu's to nu's, but I'm gonna do it on you too, just because if I don't I'm gonna get confused from my notes. So delta C mu, so now the constraint there, I'm gonna look at how this changes under the gauge transformation that I described above. Okay, so H, I'll remind you, I just won't write it again. The H shifted by D bar on C with the two indices in a symmetric fashion. So with that constraint, I have maybe I've confused myself. D bar nu, D nu plus D bar nu, D nu minus. There's two terms from that last one there, but they're traced over, so it's 2/2. D bar mu, and then D bar, make it nu, C nu. Okay, I hope I've got myself okay here. You can sort of see the effect that comes out. There's one piece that has the two D's have the same index, and then there's a pieces where it's D nu, D mu, and then minus D mu, D nu. And that's a curvature then, because it's the commutator of derivatives. So this turns into D bar squared C nu, C mu, plus R bar nu mu C mu. And so the variation of the gauge constraint that I want is delta C mu delta C nu is D bar squared plus R bar, and there's a G mu nu here, mu nu. Okay, this is a vector constraint, and so when I exponentiate, I get a vector field. So I have to take, I'm taking the determinant of that. The determinant of that is equivalent to a Gauss Lagrangian, setting a Gauss Lagrangian, L Gauss, which is, I will add a vector field, eta mu, G bar, that's G bar, mu nu, mu nu, D bar squared plus R bar mu nu, D nu. And so there's the ghost Lagrangian.
Eta.
Thank you. Yes. Eta. Nu. Good. This ends up giving a new Feynman rule. So there's a new rule that comes out of this. The if you're trying to implement this, let's take this to be K flowing in, a graviton hooking up, and K prime out. And that you're not too interested in the exact thing, but it starts off with K alpha, K beta, eta mu nu, and here's mu nu, and this guy carries alpha beta indices.
Anyway. What's eta mean nu?
Pardon me?
What's eta mean nu?
So I'm doing this in near flat space.
What are the etas on the line above them?
Those etas are fields. Okay, so this is the ghost fields. I will write the actual pathogenital max, but
are they Grassmann?
The Grassmann vector fermions.
Yep.
Yeah, Grassmann fermions. Your vectors, Grassmann vectors. Okay, actually, let's stop and just say that for a minute. When we did an engaged series, we had the constraint didn't carry a free Lorentz index. And so this, the dFT theta is a scalar, and so the Grassmann fields that you get there are just standard Grassmann fields. Here, there's for each constraint, there's a vector of constraints, and so for each constraint, there's a Grassmann field, and so this the ghost fields end up being vector fields. And that was said in Feynman's thing yesterday. He said that this dopey little particle is a vector field. He didn't say Grassmann, but he just said he subtracts it off. Okay, and that's, of course, how you get that. So the gravitational path integral is written as, at this stage, dH mu nu, d eta, that's the eta, d eta bar. And then you have e to the I, your d4x, square root of minus g, and you've got the second order thing in H. You've got the gauge fixing piece up here, that second order in H, and now we've got this ghost, which involves eta. And okay, and they all involve the background field, of course. And now,
sorry, can you explain where this cubic vertex comes in?
Okay, so I'm in the end going to use this when I'm calculating near flat space. So these fields will be normal. Propagation in near flat space, and I'm expanding this to first order in the gravitational field to get the one graviton vertex. There will also be a two graviton vertex, but it doesn't enter in anything I want. But you can just start expanding in the graviton fields near flat space and get all the vertices. Okay. And they're not too bad. These are just simple ones. Okay, so conceptually we're done. We basically just have to do those path integrals. Tuft and Veltman did it. And we're guaranteed that the result will be covariant in respect to the background field. So what we find here is it's the 1 over 16 pi squared. 1 over epsilon 1 over 120 bar squared plus 7 over 120 num. I have them. So it also comes out quadratic in the of order p to the fourth. And again, if you didn't want to invest all that effort in doing the calculation with the background field method, you could do the same thing by doing traditional Feynman diagrams, just starting in around flat space. And you would do these vertices. These are the ghosts. You'd look at the tensor structure of the end of the divergence, and you'd be able to reconstruct those two coefficients. Okay. But conceptually, it's much nicer because through the background field method, because of this invariance that you know it's going to work out to be gauge invariant. If I was just doing that, I wouldn't actually know that. Okay, any questions at that stage? Okay. So if we're looking at our field theory program, we have our Lagrangian, we've quantized, we've renormalized, those go to renormalized coefficients. We know how to do the measurements. I gave you the measurements earlier. The last thing is the predictions. And that's what I turn to now. But first, let's do a non-prediction. Okay, those coefficients there, the C1, C2, are not predictions of the effective field theory. So let's see what their effect is first. Now, I won't do all their effects, but I guess there's two things that's worth saying. So I've got my 2 over kappa squared r, and I've got C1 r squared plus C2 r mu nu. Okay. The first thing that is interesting to know that if there's only gravitons around in a matrix element, gravitons satisfy r mu nu equals to zero. And so it was treated as perturbation theory. These guys say that there's no effect of C1, C2 in a process that involves only gravitons. So that's interesting. So they disappear from such a theory. That's not true with matter around, because matter, that's no longer true. But if you have matter around here, here's a typical effect. Let's imagine I'm doing graviton exchange. I do this. And now I'm going to treat these as perturbations, so I'll do this, x, that, where this is the C1 r squared plus C2, okay? And x is then the effect of those guys, yes?
So when you say there's only gravitons, so does that mean that r bar is zero? Because you're saying that...
Yes. So now I'm going to drop the bars now. Once I've renormalized, I'll drop the bars, everything.
So R always satisfies the equation.
Yes.
The Einstein equation.
Yes, it will satisfy the Einstein equation. That's right. And that in fact was, that's the reason I dropped the linear terms in the first place is the Einstein equations are satisfied by background field.
You mean the non-linear, right? I mean the corrected Einstein.
The corrected Einstein, yes. Okay, so when I do this, let's just do it schematically, because it's, the point is obvious. I'll have at each vertex here, there's cap over 2, and I'll just call it e squared at each vertex. Then the first piece goes like 1 over q squared. And then the second piece goes like 1 over q squared. R squared goes like the four derivatives. So if I translate that into a momentum space state, it's q to the fourth, 1 over q squared. Okay. And this would be come with the CIs. Okay. So this guy turns into just a constant. And if I'm then taking this into a potential, I get the V of R equals the usual one plus a delta function. Okay. So it gives a short range effect. Again, if the coefficient was very large, you'd actually find it, and you treated it more exactly, you'd find a Yukawa, but Yukawas are can be turned into delta functions. They're representations of delta functions. Yes?
Is the statement that this top line, you did the loop of the massless scalar,
yeah.
Is that the whole action? In the sense, if I did the one AI generating function, I just get some angular action, or is this is the Wilsonian short wave like part of it? So is there something like, could there be something like R squared log R or something like that?
So the answer to that is yes, but it's, I'm going to show you the log box and terms later. Okay, so
this part is like the short wavelength part of the loop.
This is the I have absorbed the divergences, and I still have long range stuff to calculate. But again, the long range stuff is calculable, and so I will do it by calculation rather than by sticking it into a Lagrangian.
So the level of just following your notes, if we just took that graph and just evaluated the whole graph, including the finite part, we would have gotten more than just this.
Yes, exactly. Yes. So let's say I did it this old way by doing these diagrams right here. Okay. Then you sort of know what's going to happen here. This diagram is going to have a divergence, and it's going to have a log q squared in it. Okay. That log q squared is a low energy effect. Its coefficient is the same coefficient as the divergence, but that's, so we know its coefficient also. But that is then the log q squareds are the type of effects that I'm going to calculate directly. Okay? So when I do some calculation, I would, let's say I did the explicit calculation here, I would take the divergence, put it into the C1s, and I'd keep the log q squared. And then you'll actually see a calculation where I do that. Okay. All right, so this is not a prediction, but it's also not something that's measurable. It's short range, but we don't worry about it. Well, let's then do something that is a prediction. My favorite is the Newtonian potential. Now, you can get the Newtonian potential from the non-relativistic limit of one graviton exchange. I haven't done it for you, but that's pretty easy. And then we start doing loops. There are some loops that look like this. There are some loops that look like two gravitons there, like that. There's categories that look like that, where that's a two graviton vertex comes together. There's diagrams that look like this. There's box diagrams. There's cross boxes. So this goes across here. Cross boxes. There's vacuum polarizations. And then you sort of flip the diagrams over. So those are the types of diagrams that you get. And so let's imagine I'm doing this calculation. And this gives me some amplitude and momentum space, M of Q. And for illustration purposes, so that's the calculation. I'll do the calculation momentum space, but I will define a scattering amplitude from that, or scattering potential from that, by taking the non-relativistic limit, take M of Q, I take its non-relativistic limit, and I Fourier transform. Okay, so that's the calculation that I'll end up showing you. So what can we expect, and what's the predictions going to look like? So M of Q in momentum space, well, let me go non-relativistic to begin with. So GMM over Q squared is the leading piece. So there's a 1 there. That's what you get by if I just did the one graviton exchange and take non-relativistic limit. Okay. Now, things that will appear in the calculation, there's G will turn out to be M plus M, symmetric on the two masses. There's a square root of minus Q squared. That's a dimensionless variable. So G goes like 1 over mass, and so that's dimensionless. So let's put a coefficient A there, put a coefficient B here. There's G Q squared log Q squared. G again, G Q squared is dimensionless. And then there's C G Q squared. Yeah, so those are the type of terms you find. Yes.
What are your external particles in the loop diagrams?
External, they're scalars in the particular case that I first did the calculation, but you could be vectors or fermions or whatever you want.
Don't they also induce divergences?
I'm sorry?
Don't they also induce divergences?
I've calculated those too. Okay. And these guys are massive, so they're not going to give any long range potential. So I don't need to take their loops for this. Anybody else? Yes.
How did you write down those terms?
Well, it's dimensional analysis at some level. I have G, which carries 1 over mass squared. The correction is going to be linear in G. So GQ squared is an obvious one. I know from doing lots of these calculations that I'm going to get logs. So that's the obvious one. I have to admit that the very first time I did it, the G square root surprised me. And we'll actually talk a little bit more about that.
The M plus M is?
Yeah, the M plus M is just because it's symmetric under the two sides.
Yeah, and you need a mass there. But...
And you need a mass there. And the square root of Q squared is a kinematic dependence that's allowed, and which comes out of triangle diagrams, if you know your diagrams. So it comes out of that one and that one. Yeah, those are the only two places it comes. Okay. So now when we do Fourier transforms, we know the forms in position space. So that's the calculation is there, but for illustration, let's just go to Fourier transforms. This is the GMM over R is the one piece. The second piece is GM plus M. So let's do this as one plus. So this way I can do dimensionless corrections. GMM over R is the square root transforms to that. The Fourier transform of the log is B. So Q squared log Q squared. The Q squared cancels. It's just the Fourier transform of a log. It's G over R squared. And then the last piece, let me in this case, I'll close that here. The last piece is Q squared over Q squared plus then C delta function.
Okay. So there's a GM there, right, or something.
There's some GM, yes. Sheesh. Come on, I don't want to talk to you. Something like that, yes. For my point, the only thing that I care about is that it's small. And we already know something. We know that the divergences go here. Because we know the divergences look like those local terms, and we already just, by that non-prediction, so the local terms sit there. Okay, so if you stick h-bars in and make this dimensionless, there's an h-bar goes here. I'm now putting dimensions back in, and this is c squared, and there's c cubed here, if I'm not mistaken. I actually, my c's, I'm a less clear on. Anyhow, one of the interesting things here, which we'll come say something more about, is that this is the form of a classical correction. If you do the post-Newtonian expansion, you get expansions in GM over R. This is the quantum piece. There's linear and h-bar. So I turn the crank. Now let's say space and just write it here. You calculate, and you get V of R is this minus G M over R. 1 plus, you get 3 is the coefficient here. And you get 41 over 10 pi squared as the coefficient. So, as advertised, the divergences don't influence it. It's a unique number. It's in some ways a low energy theorem of quantum gravity. No matter what you do at the high energy scales, as long as they can be absorbed into those coefficients, it doesn't influence that 41 over 10 part.
Why is it independent of C1 and C2?
Pardon me?
Why is it independent?
Okay, so the independent of C1 and C2 was this thing that I did up here too. If I look at the effect of C1, C2, they come out linear. They come out just Q squared, analytic stuff. And so the
square root doesn't.
Square root, yeah, there's no square roots, there's no logs. They fall into that the category. The last one over there, it becomes a delta. And, you know, that's the type of thing that effective field theory logic would have told you in advance. So, in effective field theory, one of the things you learn is that these logs and these square roots are always independent of any of the divergences. They're low energy effects. And in a way, that's the logic is that if something can be Taylor expanded around Q squared equals to zero, it can be written as a derivative expansion then. And those are local terms, and they could look like effects of high energy. Whereas square roots and logs can never be Taylor expanded around Q squared equals to zero. And so can't end up looking as a derivative expansion. So you can you know in advance what the thing that the structure of the theory is going to be, that those terms are going to be finite. Okay? At this stage, the feature that I got the classical correction out, the classical correction, there's also some gauge choice here, which is like our harmonic gauge, but that classical correction is the same classical one you would do if you're doing post-Newtonian expansion. it's a little funny that this came out of a loop expansion, right? So normally you think about the loop expansion as being an expansion in H-bar. And it's not always true. This is a counterexample, and there are other counterexamples. If you look at the proofs of the loop expansion being an H-bar expansion, you see that there's a hidden factor of H-bar that floats around. The hidden factor let's see, what they tend to do is you pull out an H-bar in front of the Lagrangian, but then there's an H-bar hidden in the Lagrangian, because let's take the Dirac equation, and I have del slash minus m, it's m over H-bar. So it's m over H-bar, there's an H-bar in the denominator of the m in the Dirac equation. If I normalize to the derivatives being the first term. This term here that had the m, up here there's an m over H-bar and an H-bar in the numerator, and they cancel. So that, I could say more, but I can already see that I'm not going to get too far if I do that.
Since you stopped on that point.
Yeah, all right, let's.
So you've thought about it classically, that if you just had some solution to GR and you did the expansion and
yes.
The Newtonian thing, then the coefficient 3 is just there once and for all. It doesn't depend on any particle content of the universe.
Right.
It sounds like the way you're calculating it, if I did a loop of fermions, I get another content.
Yes,
of A.
If they're massless.
And what's the correspondence there, right?
So I'm sorry, there's not any other contributions to A. A comes only from these triangle diagrams. And so those are only gravitons.
Oh, I see.
So those guys, the vacuum polarization gives you only a log.
Okay.
And so the quantum correction gets changed if you have massless fermion, massless photons, for example. That's, of course, a calculable correction also. This is just the graviton piece. But that's because of the vacuum polarization. These other coefficients don't change. All right. Let's just see. All right. Let me just say a little bit more about this. This has also been done by unitarity techniques. Beer and Bohr and Geer van Hove, Barry Holstein, and I, though mostly I have to admit them, did this by using what Feynman must have originally done. You take the graviton two-particle interaction, you look at the cut, you use Feynman's tree theorem to reconstruct it. And basically, the technique is that you know that Passerino-Veltman tells us that everything goes to boxes, triangles, and bubbles. If you look at massless boxes, triangles, and bubbles, you see that there's specific identifiable cuts in those. You can then, if you take the general one and you look at the cut that you get here with on-shell states, you can tell which of these terms that you get comes from boxes, bubbles, and triangles. You then reconstruct the whole thing, and you're done. It's aided by a second thing, which I'm obviously not going to have a chance to talk about, which is the tree level general relativity amplitudes are Yang-Mills amplitudes squared. And so you use this fancy spinner notation to do that. So in this case, it's actually can be done by hand. And so it's actually much easier. It's also only physical degrees of freedom here. So none of this off-shell, no ghosts, nothing like that. All this is an equivalent to an axial gauge. And you get the same answer. This also tells you something else. Yeah, let's see if I can squeeze it onto here. That number, that 41 over 10 pi, is universal. The theorem, soft theorem. And that's basically because we know that the tree amplitudes have soft theorems. The trees at low energies have theorems that were due to originally Francis Lowe for QED, and Gross and Chakief and Weinberg and company back in the 60s. And it turns out that the same invariants that sit in the soft tree theorems end up giving you the product gives you these, the 41 over 10 pi squared piece. And so this is a soft theorem in the sense that it's independent of spin. Which had been found previously by Barry Holsey, my colleague, and Andreas Ross, my student, by painfully doing all the combinations, the vectors and spinners, you know, basically grinding it out.
So you mean if I did a photon loop, I'd get the same number?
No, so all mass, these are all massive particles. I'll do massless in just a minute. Okay, so massive, they're massive external states, but spin one massive states, spin zero massive states. There's also then spin effects, which they are also universal, but I won't. All right.
So every particle gives me 41 over 10 pi?
Yes.
Or that number is an invariant no matter how many particles I have?
That 41 over 10 pi squared is independent of what I put on the external states.
It's only coming from gravity.
It's coming from the gravity sector. And it's just talking about the external states being fermions versus bosons being spins. Okay, another calculation that you can end up doing, it's also done this using the spinner helicity techniques, is scattering of massless particles, like a photon, of massive, in other words, this is the bending of starlight, bending of light. There's no reason to do anything about this except that just point out that it has sort of the same stuff. It has actually has a log squared. It has one piece that actually now is not universal. This is different for scalars, and so this BU is it's a bubble coefficient is 3 over 40 for spin 0 and is equal to minus 11 over 120 for a photon. So there's something non-universal about this one, this amplitude, but then there's none of the equivalent tree-level soft theorems here. And you can convert that into a bending of starlight. Here's the you use Eichenholz method. There's the bending of starlight. And again, the interesting feature, surprised me, but it shouldn't surprise me, is I get the leading order piece. I get the next in the post-Newtonian expansion exactly right again. It's a classical effect. And then this guy is the quantum. So nothing fancy. This big formula here is graviton-graviton scattering. It was done by Dunbar and Norridge. And to be honest, what they did is they did a string calculation and projected down to pick out the graviton poles. But it has sort of the same structure as these. It's got lots of stuff. It got lots of logs, all the usual stuff. There is, if your eyes are good enough, there is a 1 over epsilon floating somewhere right here. Okay, there is no, so there's no C1, C2. That's in accord with what I said before about the these coefficients not appearing in the gravitational sector because of the equations of motion. There is a 1 over epsilon there. It, however, is an infrared effect. It's not an ultraviolet divergence. And I have a formula here, yeah. So the 1 over epsilon is canceled by radiation, the radiation, usual way that you get. So this is the basic idea is here is that you scatter, but when you scatter, you can emit a soft graviton. We did the check explicitly, and if you add the soft radiation to it, you get a formula that has no epsilons in it. It's nice and fine. So another low energy theorem of quantum gravity. All right, so that's...
Just to check, this is an expansion in energy.
So, yes. So you can see it here. 1 plus kappa squared S, so that's G Newton times the energy squared. And all these terms are of the next order in the unit, all the finite. Okay. The leading pieces have logs, and then there's some residual pieces left over that are not.
Is that always S, or you ever get kappa squared T?
Yeah, there's kappa squared T floating around somewhere.
TU over S squared.
Yeah, there it is. There's that type of thing you got.
There's no kappa there, right? The expansion has kappa squared.
No, well, kappa's S, so there's an S squared down there.
Oh, squared, TU over S.
TU over S. Yeah. So you find T also. I mean, you know, in a sense, if you graviton scattering, you can cross it. You find an S in one channel, you're going to find a T in another channel. Yeah, this is the particular one we're doing here is a particular helicity scattering. So if I cross it over, T becomes S anyhow. So. All right. Now, of course, it's not clear that the only thing we want to do in gravity is do scattering amplitudes. Okay? But scattering amplitudes is what quantum field theory is good for. So that's the first thing that you would do. And so we've done that. The big challenge and the future in which I can't give a quick talk is beyond scattering amplitudes. Let's say you want to do something that's truly gravitational. Okay. Now this is a more difficult problem because perturbation theory is not well set up for it. But we have an example that we've already done that tells us at least a pathway. So remember the QED. I did a massless loop in QED and I found that the Lagrangian was integral d4x minus a quarter f squared. And then I had a piece that was integral d4x, d4y, a non-local piece, coefficient something b e squared, f mu nu of x, I call a function that I called l of x minus y, f mu nu of y, and this was the Fourier transform of log q squared. Okay, that's what appeared there. And so this is This is an effect of Lagrangian, but it captures the log Q squared that we found in momentum space. Let me just do a notation change here. Let's call log X minus Y the matrix element of log box. Okay. Log box. Derivative box becomes Q squared when you go to momentum space. So if I insert momentum states there, I've in fact got exactly what I said. So then this and this was actually an action, sorry, not a Lagrangian. This action is now integral d4x minus a quarter f squared. And then I would write this as be squared f mu nu log box f mu nu. Okay. So let's imagine we try the same thing with gravity. This turns out to have been done by Barvinsky and Bukovsky. Where their goal is to now capture these quantum effects with non-local Lagrangians. Okay. Now these non-local Lagrangians are really the residual effect of doing doing loop diagrams, but in fact can be constructed a little more generally than I've done. So the action then, let's take the terms with four derivatives, d4x, square root of minus g, c1, let's just take r squared here, and the c2 is there, and then there'll be terms here later on, alpha r log box r, and beta r mu nu log box r mu nu. Okay. So we have terms like this. To be fair, you also, if you keep going on this, you find also terms that look like r squared 1 over box r, the third order in the curvature, but only still its order 4 derivatives. The non-local Lagrangians have a somewhat different expansion. This lets us do some things using this expansion in the curvature. And at this stage, I don't know how useful this is as a technique, but at least it's the start of trying to do real gravitational calculations. An example here could be if I had a collapsing universe. Friedman, Robertson, Walker. Universe be, I'm looking as a function of time, the classical, this is A dot over A, the classical behavior diverges. Sorry, that's a bad drawing. If I do these quantum type of log quantum corrections, I get a deviation that, so this is classical divergence. I get a turn. I won't say it's a bounce. It's not, I can't prove that, but you get that this was done with my student Bossom. So let me stop that part of it here, because I do want to spend time on what I would call limits of the theory. The limits of the theory there's a clear limit in the UV. Okay, we have matrix elements that go like whatever the lowest order matrix element is, 1 plus kappa ci q squared plus kappa q squared log q squared, etc. Things that and that's kappa squared, of course, so G Newton. Those are dimensionless. These guys eventually get big. This certainly falls apart. As a perturbative expansion, when G Newton Q squared DI becomes of order 1. So there's nothing in the effective field theory that treatment that can save you in that case. So high energy is a clear breakdown. And so it doesn't answer all our fundamental questions about gravity. It's not a complete theory at all energies. The quantum theory at low energy. I want to insert another page here. However, I think even more interesting is infrared limits, at least to calculations. Okay, I don't know if there are limits to the effective field theory itself, limits to perturbation theory, or how to get around it. The basic feature is that gravitational effects grow with distance. You can see this, for example, in the Schwarzschild metric. You have terms that look like 1 over 2 gm over r. This could, for all reasonable ranges, have small curvature if the mass is big enough. For large m. Yet, nevertheless, if you're talking between infinity and the horizon, even though the curvature has been small all the way between there, it adds up to a large effect. Perturbative quantum calculations, we don't know how to add up those effects. I can do an effect that's locally valid out in this small region out where the curvature is very small. But since the gravitational field propagates long distances, it can actually be sensitive to the fact that there's a horizon there. And it is. So there is some sensitivity to very infrared effects. In a non-trivial space-time. And that's actually obvious if I try doing fractions to a black hole. I won't say do it here, but in fact I can see in the calculation that despite my best efforts, I'm sensitive to physics that's beyond the horizon or near the horizon, because I can propagate from out here all the way into the horizon. If I'm doing perturbation theory, it's going to fall apart at some scale. So perturbation theory is sensitive to this. So let's put perturbation theory is sensitive to that. Cliff has been working on also interesting effects with horizons, which are not just generalistic effects. There's a recent paper with Rindler space-time and ordinary perturbation theory, but these situations where you have horizons leads to IR problems, long time, long distance problems for perturbation theory. So I think there's a big frontier to understanding those type of effects also. And I can't say we have a clear understanding of those. That's basically what I'd like.
So people often in this context talk about Trans-Planckian issues and things being redshifted. Would you have a comment on that?
Yeah. I am looking at Trans-Planckian stuff. So the Trans-Planckian problem is that, you know, I can prepare a particle here, isolated particle, and boost it by a Lorentz transformation so that in some rest frame it has any energy. And I take another particle over here, I boost it in some rest frame that has any energy. I look at the scattering amplitudes. The scattering amplitudes get large, even when you're not. In fact, they grow like G Newton times S. Some of that you can sum up using summation techniques. Some of it we don't know how to sum at the moment. It's not clear to me that there's a fundamental problem. It happens. But we don't know how to handle it. It's one that just adding higher terms in the effect of Lagrangian is not going to handle. But resummation techniques could.
I mean, you really expecting to see the formation of black holes? I mean, that sounds hard.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't expect to see formation of black holes in perturbation theory, but that's...
So why do you expect to make it work?
I actually think that the perturbative treatment isn't actually, when you're doing the two-to-two scattering, you're not seeing formation of black holes. Two-to-many is the formation of black holes, and we haven't done that yet. So I actually think that if you're doing two-to-two, you actually can solve that by using standard field theory techniques. The two-to-many problem is also an interesting problem, and that's the black hole. Okay. We know how to do, we do know some of the two-to-many problem. We know the Reggie's behavior, which is essentially a, when you cut it as a two-to-many. I don't want to do that, but it is in my research proposal. All right.
But the different Trans-Planckian issue is sometimes people say that if you're looking at Hawking radiation, let's say, you wanted to do some effective thing. Yeah. You track that stuff back far enough, and it's pretty close to the horizon, and it gets blue shifted, and at some point.
Yeah.
So you had to say what high energy was.
Back then, yeah.
Say that, and then as you get close to the horizon, it sounds like you're always got a thing coming across here.
Yeah, that's part of this issue if you hear of the gravitational effects build up over long times, which other field theories don't have this behavior. I mean, that's the type of thing that I am meaning when I'm saying this. Anyway, let me try to end on a happy note. from those quotes at the beginning, I think we see that at least the quotes at the beginning are wrong. You know, the ones that say that it's meaningless theory, can't make predictions because of divergences, we've seen how to get around that. There are still issues. I make the case that the gravitational field theory is the most interesting field theory that we have at the moment. Everything else is not as interesting. But I love this quote of Wilczek. A lot of pretentious drivel has been written about quantum theory of gravity. There's a perfectly well-defined quantum theory of gravity that agrees accurately with all available experimental data. Now, of course, it agrees accurately because the predictions are so tiny and the experimental data is so weak, I guess classical. And so that part is a joke. But the perfectly well-defined quantum theory of gravity is not, he didn't mean it as a joke anyhow. He means it in the sense that we just described. And so we can, I would argue we've at least achieved our goal of treating general relativity on the same foundation footings as the other fundamental interactions. We know that the theory has limits. We know there are calculational problems associated with the theory, but the theory is predictive at low energies, predictive for a range of energies, ordinary energies, things that where we don't run into extreme fields or extreme energies. Thank you.